Today is Tuesday, March 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
Hope and enthusiasm for Africa have been a consistent theme since Tibor Nagy took over as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs late last year. But the self-described Afro-optimist...
Also ahead, the top U.S. diplomat in Africa criticizes South Africa's support of Venezuela's embattled president, Nicolas Maduro. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States says it is removing all remaining personnel from its embassy in Venezuela this week, partly because of the deteriorating situation in the South American nation. Non-emergency personnel left Venezuela in January, days after President Nicolas Maduro ended diplomatic relations with Washington and President Trump officially recognized Juan Guaido as interim president. The U.S. embassy closing announcement came as Maduro repeated his assertion that the U.S. is behind Venezuela's nationwide power outage, entering its sixth day today. While U.S. Deputy Secretary of State John J. Sullivan visits South Africa and Angola this week to discuss a range of issues, including trade and anti-corruption efforts, according to the top U.S. diplomat in Africa, Tibor Nagy. Although Nagy described most of the discussion topics as positive, he also offered criticism of South Africa's support of Venezuela's embattled president, Nicolas Maduro. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg. We're having some technical difficulties with that report, so we will just move on to our next story. France, Britain, Germany, Malaysia, and Oman are the latest countries to suspend the Boeing 737 MAX 8 passenger jet from operating in their respective airspaces, joining a growing list of countries taking precautionary measures involving the plane after its second fatal crash in 5 months. Airlines in countries across the globe, including China, Turkey, Indonesia, Brazil, and Mexico, Australia, Singapore, South Korea, and Norway, have grounded all the MAX 8 jets in their respective fleets. Going back to our next story now with Anita Powell, who will be talking about U.S. Deputy Secretary of State John J. Sullivan's visit to South Africa and Angola.
Hope and enthusiasm for Africa have been a consistent theme since Tibor Nagy took over as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs late last year. But the self-described Afro-optimist, who spent more than two decades posted on the continent, hit a snag when describing a new U.S. disagreement with longtime ally South Africa over Venezuela's contentious power struggle. Last month, South Africa was one of three members of the United Nations Security Council, along with Russia and China, to vote against a U.S. resolution calling for the recognition of opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. Nagy said he was disappointed by South Africa's move and expects Sullivan to make that clear during meetings with South African officials.
What Maduro is doing to Venezuela is, in my view, it's literally a crime. And interim president Guaido is offering a solution. He's been out empowered by the National Assembly. And why countries cannot come together to see that, for me, that is, in effect, very puzzling, and I'm absolutely certain that that will be a topic of discussion.
In its statement on the vote, South Africa said the U.S. resolution reflected a serious bias and partiality which goes against South Africa's constitution and foreign policy, as well as the letter and spirit of the Charter of the United Nations. Nagy did not elaborate on consequences if South Africa doesn't come around, although he noted that Sullivan will also be discussing trade in meetings with officials. Sullivan, who began his week-long tour Tuesday, will also visit Angola. Nagy praised Angolan President João Lourenço's efforts to stamp out corruption in an oil-rich nation that was notorious for it during the rule of Lourenço's predecessor, José Eduardo dos Santos.
I think all observers have been absolutely pleasantly, delightfully surprised by what President Lourenço and his government have been doing. We absolutely support his efforts to fight corruption. We know that there's a long way to go because that has been one of the perennial complaints from American investors. And as you know, one of our top line goals in Africa is to increase American trade and investment so that there's not just, you know, few investors going there. So we are absolutely delighted. We will work with the Angolan government. We will be as supportive as possible, and we will do our best to bring even more trade and investment to Angola.
Naj also said U.S. officials expect South Africa to agree to its request to extradite former Mozambican finance minister Manuel Chang for trial. Chang, arrested last year in South Africa on a U.S. warrant, faces charges in the U.S. for his alleged role in a $2 billion debt scandal that has wrought economic chaos in Mozambique. Naj pointed out that South Africa signed an extradition treaty with the U.S. 20 years ago.
We expect in such arrangements that both parties will honor that treaty, so we are very much expecting that will happen.
Both the U.S. and Mozambique are trying to extradite Chang, and a Johannesburg court is handling both competing requests. Chang's lawyers say he would rather go to Mozambique. Critics of Mozambique's government say they suspect a Mozambican court will go easier on Chang than an American court would. Naj is midway through a four-nation tour that includes Uganda, Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Cameroon. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Anita. Well, thousands of protesters were in the streets in Algerian cities today, a day after President Abdelaziz Bouteflika bowed to unprecedented public protest and promised not to seek a fifth term after 20 years in power. In a letter to the nation, the ailing leader also said the presidential election scheduled for April 18th would be postponed. He promised to establish a panel to plan a rescheduled vote. Protesters said the president's announcement was a ploy to buy time and keep him in power longer. Bouteflika, who is 82, has barely been seen in public since a 2013 stroke. His decision to run again set off protests in February that have expanded to include broader complaints about corruption and heavy-handed security policies. International Edition's Lori London asked Will Fisher, former Australian ambassador to Algeria, how unusual it is to see protests of this scale in Algeria.
Over the last few days, it's become clear that the demonstrations have had really impressive effect on le pouvoir. Algeria is run not really by an individual like Bouteflika, but by a rather shadowy, or a very shadowy group of people who are generally known as le pouvoir. And over the last few days, a number of essential things have gone wrong for them. For example, 1,000 judges have said they won't supervise the elections. Then some people in the senior ranks of the army, which is most significant, have indicated that things must change. I think it's become clear to the various participants in Le Pouvoir that the game has got to change. That doesn't mean that Bouteflika is necessarily going too quickly, because, as you know, the decision has been that they will not hold the elections as scheduled in a few days, and that means that he stays in power for an indeterminate period. He's calling a constitutional type convention. This is a new thing in Algeria. Heaven knows what that might mean and who'd be in it and how it'd be run. So that could be a process of weeks, months, years, and who knows about that. It can be done. Next door in Tunisia, they did it after the fall of Ben Bella, and the process was very efficiently run by the Tunisians. So it's not impossible that a fairly rapid new constitution can be drafted, but I think it's not very likely that that would happen. And in the meantime, the situation continues sort of bubbling along without any immediate resolution for an indeterminate period, with Bouteflika at least nominally in position. But don't forget, he's been out of sight, out of play now for about 5 years. I don't think he's been seen in public since about 2013. And whether he actually participates in day-to-day government, who knows? It's such an obscure regime that nobody knows what's happening inside it.
And if he were, in fact, to do as he says he's going to do, which is to withdraw from a bid for another term in office, there would be no guarantee that the person that does ultimately take his place would be the sort of leader that these protesters are looking for.
There are hundreds of thousands of protesters, and nobody could guess at what sort of person they're looking for. And in a way, that doesn't matter, because firstly, who knows what sort of regime will emerge after this constitutional convention, and as I said earlier, however long that might take. And secondly, the ruling power group, what is called Le Pouvoir in Algiers, will still hold the power, So whoever they put up will presumably get elected. That's not to say that they will put up just one person. No, there may be some sort of choice. I just don't see really the possibility of anything like a new and open regime taking its place.
That was Will Fisher, former Australian ambassador to Algeria, speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Among the top stories in the world, a spokesman for U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces predicts only a little more time is needed until the Islamic State enclave of Baghouz is liberated. And Houthi rebels and the Saudi-led coalition are blaming each other for the deaths of more than 20 civilians, including children, in a village in northern Yemen over the past several days. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. French President Emmanuel Macron is visiting East Africa, where he looks to expand French military, business, cultural, environmental ties on the African continent. Today, he visits France's oldest and biggest foreign military base in Djibouti on the Horn of Africa. Macron will also visit two rising Anglophone powerhouses, Ethiopia and Kenya, where his visit to Nairobi will be a first by a French president since Kenya's 1963 independence. I spoke with reporter Catherine Field about the significance of Macron's visit to East Africa.
In particular, President Macron has felt that France really hasn't played its diplomatic cards effectively in East Africa, and particularly in Djibouti, a former French colony. Also Ethiopia, a country that France previously had very good relations with. So President Macron is really feeling that now is the time to boost this, not just its presence to, in fact, further the peace in the Horn of Africa, but also its economic presence there. So it's really just putting right an area that Macron had felt had been ignored.
Many say he is taking this trip to East Africa at a time where there are many problems in France. So is this a good time for him to be traveling to Africa?
Well, it would seem to be. Yes, he does have a lot of problems at home. The demonstrations, the so-called yellow vest protests, have started to calm down, certainly much smaller in number, and the focus has gone away there. This particular trip, though, his advisors said he didn't want to put this trip off. There are other visits that he has delayed that have been shunted further down the calendar for later in the year. But they felt that this particular one just could not be missed. And when you look at right through his agenda for this visit, it really does touch on a lot of the issues that could well affect his electorate. Let's have a look at Djibouti, Ethiopia, and also Kenya. Emmanuel Macron is going to all these places with businessmen, with an idea to give infrastructure support, to help with manufacturing. So it's something that he will actually, he hopes at least, be able to come back and show the French people that he's been able to really go out there and beat the drum for French business. You look at, again at Kenya, he's going there, he's going to be talking about helping set up rapid train system there as service, similar to what he helped to set up in Senegal. These are the sort of measures that the French electorate like, and these are the sort of business opportunities that France has become quite renowned for in West Africa, but certainly less so in East Africa.
Also, he's going there at a time where China is exerting its influence over East Africa.
Indeed. This is, again, one of the other reasons I personally think that Emmanuel Macron has decided that this visit has to go ahead now. We're looking very much at China's growing influence in the region. You take, for example, in Djibouti, where there's a French naval base. France has 1,400 soldiers there, 5 operational facilities. Well, China also now has a military base there. They set up that military base in 2017. And in many nations across Africa, we're seeing Chinese firms investing in infrastructure projects, the sort of big projects that French companies used to be involved with. So Emmanuel Macron really wants to make sure that the French flag is still there. That having been said, he has put aside a fair amount of time for his other real focus, which is sustainable development and the environment. He's going to be visiting the African Union headquarters in Ethiopia. There he's going to be talking about sustainable development, and he's going to the One Planet Summit in Kenya. So it really is two particularly important issues which he feels he can deal with on this particular visit. But at the same time, he's also looking at other areas. For example, in Ethiopia, he's going to be going to the area of the cave churches, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site that are at the risk of erosion through mass tourism. Well, he's going to be going there and he's going to be saying, look, we have experience with this. We can send out experts to help you with this. We can also give money. So again, we're looking at him going for as much on the big business and seeing off other competitors, as well as that cultural element that the French also like to go hand in hand.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. Well, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani began a three-day visit to Iraq yesterday by meeting host President Barham Saleh amid hopes of increasing the volume of trade between the two countries despite U.S. economic sanctions that were imposed on Tehran in August and November of last year. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
An Iraqi military band played bagpipes as an honor guard welcomed President Hassan Rouhani to the Qasr al-Salam Palace in Baghdad's Green Zone to confer with Iraqi President Barham Saleh and other top leaders. Arab media reported that Saleh did not travel to the airport to meet Rouhani in what some were interpreting as a minor snub. Rouhani made a special visit to the revered Shiite mausoleum of Imam Musa Khazim. The Iranian president is hoping to meet Iraq's top Shiite dignitary, Ayatollah Ali Sistani, although Arab media reported that it was not clear if the Ayatollah would see him. Sistani has not met with foreign political leaders since 2015. During a televised news conference, Presidents Rouhani and Saleh talked about strengthening political and economic ties between the two countries, which fought a brutal and bloody eight-year war from 1980 to 88, in which more than a million people died. Saleh told reporters that Iraq has been the battleground for conflicts between regional and international powers, adding it is imperative that regional states cooperate to combat terrorism for mutual economic benefit. Saleh says that he hopes that Iraq's neighbors understand that stability in his country is important for everyone's interest. He adds that many claim that Iraq is in a bad geographic location, but he says that his country has the good fortune to have Iran, Turkey, and the Arab states for neighbors. Despite U.S. economic sanctions placed on Tehran by the Trump administration last year and efforts by Washington to urge regional states like Iraq to observe them, Rouhani appeared to be eager to increase trade with Baghdad. Rouhani says that there are many possible fields of cooperation between Iran and Iraq, including trade, investment, joint industrial and trade zones, along with tourism. He stresses the need to strengthen cooperation over energy, including oil, gas, and electricity, along with industrial cooperation and cooperation in road, rail, and water links. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA that he doesn't think that the U.S. will be able to stop trade between Iraq and Iran despite clamping down on the banking sector.
They keep trading. There's no doubt about it. And I don't think the U.S. can stop this trade. However, the volume of trade between Iraq and Turkey is significantly larger than the volume of trade between Iraq and Iran. Iranian products are not of good quality and they don't compare to Turkish goods.
Kashan says he thinks that some members of the Iraqi government have resisted increasing trade with Iran because of the low quality of Iranian goods and because of ill feelings over Iran's unwillingness to provide electricity to border regions when it was most needed. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Mm-hmm.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, Britain's parliament is to hold the first of what could be 3 days of voting on the country's planned withdrawal from the EU. Members in London are to vote today on the latest version of the plan, which is based on a deal reached with EU negotiators last year. British Prime Minister Theresa May met yesterday with EU Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker in Strasbourg, France, to discuss changes to the plan. May said Juncker agreed to, in her words, to legally binding changes that deal with Britain's Northern Ireland border with EU member Ireland.
Having an insurance policy to guarantee that there will never be a hard border in Northern Ireland is absolutely right. It honours the UK's solemn commitments in the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. But if we ever have to use that insurance policy, it cannot become a permanent arrangement.
The issue known as the backstop has been a major point of disagreement. Supporters of withdrawal from the EU or Brexit are concerned the earlier agreement would lock Britain into EU trade rules. May said the new terms ensure that the backstop deal is not permanent.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists with the LAMP or Lyman Alpha Mapping Project report that they have detected water molecules moving around on the surface of the light side of the moon. LAMP is an instrument on NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. LAMP scientists at the Southwest Research Institute in Texas found that the water molecules normally cling to lunar soil or tiny rocks at night and most of the day. When temperatures on the moon's surface hits its peak around midday, the water molecules are released and then hop around the moon's surface until they find a nearby location cold enough for them to stick to materials, or they rise into the moon's very thin atmosphere. When temperatures drop, those molecules fall back to the surface and again cling on to lunar material. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says of the prospect of launching impeachment proceedings against U.S. President Donald Trump, he's just not worth it. Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
Pelosi's been resisting pressure from some Democrats to start impeachment proceedings, but is now going further, telling the Washington Post President Trump's just not worth it, and she's not for impeachment, later saying much of the same to NBC News.
It divides the country, unless there's some conclusive evidence that takes us to that place.
It's different from her earlier statements that Democrats will wait on special counsel Bob Mueller's report before considering impeachment. Democratic thinking has shifted in part because of the possibility the report may not be decisive. Sarah Sanders' response here on Pelosi waving off impeachment, I agree. Sagar Magani at the White House.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Well, thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.